Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. I'm Loralee, and this is The Loralee Show. And if you enjoy this radio show, well, you have likely pondered the meaning of life and explored spirituality and religion in your search for some answers. And so have your fellow Americans in ways and avenues unprecedented in recent decades. We're part of the team that is changing the face of America's religion and spiritual quest today. And we have with us Wade Clark Roof, who studies this. He's one of the leading experts in religion and spirituality and the landscape of that in America today. He's the author of a couple of books on this, Spiritual Marketplace, Baby Boomers and the Remaking of American Religion, just out, and the earlier bestseller, A Generation of Seekers. He's a professor of religion and society at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's got surveys, he's got statistics, and he'll share his insights into our nation's collective search in all of its diversity. There's a number of new emerging subcultures, and we'll talk about why so many of us nowadays value personal spirituality over traditional forms of religion and the impact that this trend has. Hi, Clark, and welcome to our show.
Hello, Loralee. Thank you.
Thank you. What got you interested in this this quest and the way that you are looking at this picture?
Well, for the past 10 years, I've been interviewing baby boomers because they are such a very important part of our American population. They're the biggest generation ever in American history. They grew up in the 1960s and 1970s. So they've been a part of a lot of change in American society. So you really can't understand America today without understanding the baby boomers.
Ah, we're an interesting crowd. And what brought you to look at religion and spirituality? Where does that fit in the overall picture of the human being, the individual, the American landscape?
Well, when you start really inquiring into people's lives, you can start talking about their work, their marriages, their families, their leisure. And before long, you're going to get into these very intangible things called values and beliefs. And I discovered in all my interviewing with people over the past 10 years that the thing we keep getting back to, no matter where we start, we get back to questions about, is life meaningful? What's the purpose of it all? What are we doing this for?
Mm-hmm.
So my interest in spirituality developed because I discovered, and I think it really is the case, that Americans today, and particularly people in this baby boom generation, people roughly between the ages of 35 and 55, are at a very critical point in asking very serious questions about life.
Hasn't that always been the case? I mean, hasn't every generation asked very serious questions for life? Are we different because we aren't satisfied with the previous answers?
Well, I think both of those are true. Certainly every generation has asked questions about the meaning of life. Nothing new about that. I think, however, that those questions are particularly pointed here at the end of the century, end of a millennium, for several reasons. One is the baby boomers have explored so many options in their early years. They've tried just about everything, if not everything, as a source of fulfillment. And like many people have discovered that that materialism in the end doesn't have all the answers, even though it's a very seductive kind of quest. Many people have tried finding final answers in their work and career, and of course that's very important. But in midlife, as so many of these Americans now are, I think they're discovering that there's more to life than just material accomplishment or achievement or work, as important as those things are. Mm-hmm. And I certainly don't in any way imply they're not important. But ultimately, people are looking for something more. They want a reason for why they are going through the motions of life.
Boy, that nails it on the head, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Some of us started out from day one with those questions, though. I mean, I didn't wait to this point to ask those questions. Some of us, and I think a lot of us in this category, were asking them from day one.
I think that's true. We discovered that, or at least our people told us in our interviews, and we've interviewed several thousand baby boomers, my research team and I. Many of the people did, in fact, tell us that from their early days as adults, from high school on, they've asked a lot of serious questions about
and
life.
And I bet you're going to enjoy a callist tonight telling you some of those same issues. What's important to them? What's valuable to them about life and the meaning for life and the search for life? Our chance to tell Clark Roof about ourselves and his chance to tell us about ourselves. Coming up as we look at spirituality today, I'm Laura Lee. I'm Laura Lee. This is The Laura Lee Show. This show has always been about the who are we, where did we come from, where are we going, and what's life all about. And so I'm pleased to have Clark Roof join us tonight, because those are some of the questions that he examines in terms of the subcultures in America today, particularly focusing on us baby boomers, and how we are making an impact in religion, spirituality, changing the landscape here. And you know, Clark, I think that every generation has to find its own answers to those questions. What is the meaning of life? What's the meaning of my life? Our experiences are different. Our society evolves. We have different pressures and concerns and challenges than the generation ahead of us. Our society is changing at such an unprecedented rate with technologies and overpopulation and all of this, that, and also learning more about the world around us and ourselves than ever before, this naturally has to affect our worldview, and this naturally has to affect our relationship with God, our relationship with one another, and our relationship with ourself. Ergo, you have a change in our spiritual quest. No doubt about it. You're examining how is that changing? Why is that changing? And this is such fascinating material. Before we get to, I want to hear about your studies and your surveys and the research that you did. We have a caller that says he has to talk to you now, and that would be Steve in San Luis Obispo on KGLO Radio. Hi, Steve. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I want to ask this question, and I want to preface it by saying I don't mean to offend anyone.
No offense taken.
Questions have been rambling around in my mind for about 20 years now, and it begins this way, because of I have a son who's a baby boomer, in fact. How can anyone in our modern world, knowing what we know about science and this Hubble telescope and so on, how can anyone take the stories in the Bible seriously where it says that there were 3 days and three nights before the sun and the moon were created, and the genealogy of man is so messed up in the Old Testament, you don't know who was when and where and so on. And I think it probably leaves a lot of people sort of hanging out a limb here saying, where do I go now? What do I look for now?
The old answers aren't working. Clark?
That's right.
Well, Clark, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here, and I heard the question, and it's a good one.
It is.
You know, we've inherited so much from the past that it's very easy if one looks literally at words, say from the Bible or from other religious texts, in light of scientific discovery and all we know about the modern world and how things operate, it's not at
difficult at all to find discrepancies and things that we can't accept on face value. But if you think of spiritual quest as a search for meaning despite all the discrepancies, or perhaps because of all the discrepancies that we know about in life, then the modern world creates a situation in which we hunger even more for some kind of explanation of things, even as we recognize that many of the old answers may not be totally valid or totally acceptable given what we know about today's world. But that in itself, it seems to me, is a very important reason why here at the end of the 20th century, knowing as much as we do, we discover how little we know about some very important things about our life.
And you were not the first ones, too. There was an article I read recently about Abraham Lincoln and his personal faith, and it said he didn't believe in a personal God. He didn't believe in Jesus Christ. This came up during his election candidacy, and he had to put out a statement, and he said that I am not a member of any Christian church is true, but he denied any disrespect toward religion in general or any Christian group. And so, and it says that his own personal struggles with a personal belief system about God and religion helped to put the issue of freedom of from slavery into the mix during the Civil War. He had to find a higher purpose for it. It was fascinating how these issues I've touched all of us, and there are so many leading thinkers who've questioned these, and I think it's so important to question this.
I think so much of life's discoveries come out of the hard struggles and questions that we have.
Yes.
So that we learn out of our questions. And it's not that we get firm, conclusive answers.
Yeah, forget it. Don't even put that as a goal, because it's not going to happen.
Because it's not going to happen. But we gain perspective on the problem by virtue of having the question.
Yes, and it adds so much texture and depth to life. And it just makes everything just much more interesting. That's one of the first benefits to this, as well as being honest to yourself. Anything else you want to say about that, Steve?
Well, the only thing that disturbs me is I'm on the Internet sometimes, and I run down quickly to look at the news, and the news is inevitably war in about 20 different places on Earth, and about 18 of those places are religious wars.
Uh-huh.
And I just happen to be one of the kind of people that really bothers me that we don't know what we're talking about, if you'll forgive me, and yet we will destroy each other over beliefs, you know. And so when I heard this gentleman was going to be on there, I grabbed the phone as quickly as possible. Now I want to thank him for his answer, and I want to thank you again for taking my call.
Well, thanks for calling in. You can call in as well at 800-800-5287. We have plenty of time tonight to spend with Clark Roof about this whole question, what's the meaning of life? And you'll be pleased to know you're not alone in this search, that the entire face of religion and spirituality today is being changed. We're forging new courses in this. Why don't we hear about your research, Clark? A bit about the surveys that you've conducted. You focused in on baby boomers, but of course you're really looking at, you know, the big picture here and all of this various subgroups that are emerging. People are searching, turning over every stone. It's interesting how people are more interested now in ancient mysteries, in past wisdom traditions, in old and new.
I think that's one of the fascinating things that we discovered in our research. Briefly on the research, for 10 years we have interviewed baby boomers across America in all the states, but particularly in California, North Carolina, Massachusetts, and Ohio, four states where we had funding to do intensive interviewing. But we've interviewed people all over the country. And I had large grants from the Lilly Endowment and the Pew Charitable Trust to support this research. We've talked to approximately 1,800 people and had intensive interviews with around 700. Some people we've talked to three and four times over this 10-year period. So I'm able to chart some of the changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the fascinating things that we discovered, and you just alluded to it, is that despite all our talk about being modern, despite all we know about the scientific world, there's this incredible thirst today to discover ancient mysteries. There's something about the wisdom of the past that people can't let go of, that it seems to offer meaning and purpose to life in ways that much of our newer discoveries and theories fail to do. And I think that's fascinating because, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, the philosophers were predicting that with science, all of these big questions about what is the meaning of life would just go away because science would answer all the questions. And here, as we approach year 2000, millions of Americans are looking backward rather than forward in search of answers.
Is that the pendulum effect? Is that the effect where you see a similar effect in people want handcrafted goods as opposed to modern because modern has lost its appeal and the old and handcrafted look, you know, that's just one example. We swing backwards.
It's certainly complex.
We want to go into balance. And another thing is when science tells us that a near-death experience is simply a function of a part of your brain that's being stimulated and it's all an illusion, you know, science is painting such a grim picture of consciousness and of God and of spirituality and all of that, that it's all illusory. And many of us know, nope, sorry, there's something to this. There's a much larger world out there. And it's not just physical. The physical isn't the end-all and be-all of life. And so, yes, we look back to the ancient wisdom because that seems to be the cultures which manage to incorporate the larger picture of life. And nicely mix that together.
As so, I see it, we're perched on the turn of a new millennium, and we are at a point in history when many of the old certainties that we once thought would never fade indeed have faded, and we're asking lots of new questions. They're not really new questions, but we're asking them in new ways. And we're searching for answers. We're looking wherever we can look for answers to many of life's basic questions. And what's fascinating, aside from this this appreciation for the wisdom from the past, is that Americans are looking inward, and they're asking serious questions of themselves. They're asking, how can I, in my life circumstance, find a purpose which will satisfy me?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a deeply personal dimension to this quest. It's not as if there's a single answer out there that presumably will work for all people or anything.
It's not
like
a one-size-fit-all.
No. This is something that has to be tailored to my particular concerns and questions. Now, often many people will find that they have comrades asking similar questions, and they do band together and bond together in that quest, but it does have a deeply personal dimension.
What I like, too, is the atmosphere of experimentation that goes on. We have freedom of religion in this country. We have access to old and new worldwide experiments in seeking those answers. This is a period in time when we can know so much about what other cultures and society, past and present, have done to search for those answers. So the experimentation aspect is joyful.
I think that's one of the places where the baby boom generation is really different from previous generations, at least different in terms of scale. No generation yet, except possibly the generation or two even younger than baby boomers, have been exposed to more pluralism in terms of belief systems, other cultures, lifestyles, values, etc. No more exposure than I mean, there's more exposure now than ever before in human history. So one is challenged in new ways to think through one's own views, because one's neighbor is likely to have views that are quite different.
There's so many choices out there. You really have to find out
exactly
who am
right.
I
it's,
amidst
it's a
all
culture
that.
Of choice, and in a we all treasure choice. We want choice, and yet choice brings with it its own burdens too. It means that we as individual selves have to assume a degree of responsibility for what we will believe and what we will work out in our own lives. Old inherited answers aren't necessarily working so well. Individuals now must reflect on their own lives and try to work it out for themselves.
Seek or know thyself is a good place to start to find out where you want to go from there. We continue with Clark Roof. You might want to pick up his fascinating two books, Spiritual Marketplace, Baby Boomers and the Remaking of American Religion, and A Generation of Seekers. I'm Laura Lee. I'm Laura Lee. This is The Laura Lee Show. Our guest is Clark Roof, author of A Generation of Seekers and Spiritual Marketplace. Can you describe the subgroups with all this experimentation going on that we've been describing? Some of the subgroups that have emerged today that weren't on the scene prior?
Well, the major subgroups that we find in America today, limit the major ones to four or five, but keep in mind that the United States is the most pluralistic religious country in the world. We have 2,200 different organized religions in the United States.
2,200 different organized religions.
That is correct.
Those are the ones that declared themselves,
right? Those are the ones that have declared themselves. There are 2,200 religions with a central office somewhere so that you could get information about what they believe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, there are millions of offshoots, literally. If you think of it in terms of individuals, Thomas Jefferson said, I am my own sect, S-E-C-T, meaning I am my own religion, and Americans love that because we're very individualistic and we like to think for ourselves. So,
yeah.
So this country is full of religions. Now, a sociologist like myself tries to make some sense of that great diversity by reducing it down to some major groups. And
we have time for four or five.
Okay, well,
not the millions.
Yeah, right. One major constituency in the United States today clearly is born-again Christians. We're talking about roughly 25-26% of the population.
Wow.
That's a sizable group. Now, they come in enormous varieties. I'm talking Pentecostals, I'm talking evangelicals, I'm talking various types of
what do they all have in common?
What they have in common is a declaration of a personal relationship with Jesus.
Okay.
A personal relationship with Jesus. Now, there are other Christians who don't emphasize so much the personal relationship with Jesus, but still claim to be Christian. And so a second group we might call mainline believers, mainline only because they are associated with some of the old historic churches that go way back for 200 years or so, and in this country. And there's another constituency right there of about 15 or 20% people who are Christian but don't talk very much about the born again part.
Mm-hmm.
So that's two. A third group.
And that group is smaller than the born-agains.
Yes, it is now smaller, and particularly among the baby boom generation.
Wow.
There's a group of metaphysical believers. Now, this is a very, very diverse group. These are nature worshipers. Some of these people are pagan, neo-pagan. Some of these people claim to be witches or to practice witchcraft. There are people who believe very strongly in nature healings, people who hold to metaphysical notions about life and its meaning, some notions about flow of energy that flows through people and through the universe. This particular group does not claim to have a personal conception of God. And they tend to have more abstract notions of God, cosmic force, life force, the force, any number of expressions like that.
So we can put George Lucas in that group
with the
force.
Yes, and many so-called New Agers and New Spiritualists belong to this group.
Where would Native Americans go? They're very established. They're more established in many ways than some of the Western religions.
Sure. Well, that's one of those.
But they're metaphysical.
Yes, because
they don't have a personal
there's
God.
A strong emphasis on nature and relationship to the land.
Right.
And but that's a pretty important theme for many Americans: relationship to the land. And nature worship, ever since John Moore and his trips to the Great National Forest, or what became the National Forest here in California 75 years ago, we've known that nature worship is a very important theme in the American experience. So by my count, another 15 or 20% of Americans fit some brand of what I'm calling metaphysical belief.
Now, though the metaphysical groups are seen as fringe groups, they constitute as large a portion as the mainline believers associated with old historic churches.
Yes.
They're equal in
number. They wouldn't be as large as the born-again Christians and the mainline believers.
No, but you said the mainline believers constitute 15 to 20%.
That's
the
right.
Metaphysical group constitute 15 to 20%.
That's correct.
Okay. And what's the fourth group?
The fourth group are dogmatists. Dogmatists. Now, dogmatists are people who are pretty rigid in their views, are convinced they've got the truth, and that a lot of other people are wrong. And I
run into a few of those.
I differentiate between dogmatists and born-again Christians. Many born-again Christians have moved in a direction over the past 15 or 20 years toward a more accommodating, somewhat more relativist way of thinking. I wouldn't want to exaggerate that, and I'm sure some people in the radio audience will
take
be a little
to
upset
that.
Or take homage to that point of view. But there is this cleavage emerging, according to my data, between many born-again Christians and fundamentalists.
Oh.
Now, fundamentalists are closer to what I'm calling dogmatists. That is, fairly closed-minded, rigid view about the nature of the sacred, the nature of salvation, one way, one truth.
Mm-hmm.
Many born-again Christians, while they do emphasize a clear, strong relationship with Jesus, are also open, actually, to the wisdom from other traditions. And one of the things that we see happening in American religion is...
You have to tell us on the other side of this break, and what do the dogmatists constitute? What percentage? We'll find out.
About 14 to 15%.
And what about the atheists? How many are those in American life today? We continue with our guest, Clark Roof, and his survey of American spirituality and religion today. I'm Laura Lee. I am having so much fun. The meaning of life is my favorite topic of discussion. Maybe you've noticed if you've been a long-time listener to the show in all of its aspects. And here tonight we have as our guest Wade Clark Roof. He's a well-known commentator on religious trends in America today. He is the J.F. Rowney Professor of Religion and Society at the University of California in Santa Barbara. He's written 8 books, including A Generation of Seekers and The Spiritual Marketplace. a very good read if you want to pick up a copy at 800-243-1438. And we are taking your calls. We're discussing, and we just want to finish this this list up, the various subcultures that Clark has identified through intensive interviews with 700 people, overall interviews with 1,800 people, and many, many other studies and ways of looking at the landscape here of belief and questing for meaning of life today. He's described born-again Christians constituting 26% of the population. He defines those as those who have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. He's defined mainline believers who are associated with the old historic churches as constituting another 15 to 20% of Americans today. He's identified a metaphysical group and a very diverse group. This is from nature worshippers to those interested in ancient wisdom traditions to Native Americans would belong in this group to a whole panoply, having in common not a personal concept of God, but more universal concept of God, constituting another 15 to 20%. And I bet this overlaps with Dr. Paul Ray's cultural creatives in a large way. He's described another group of dogmatists. He would put fundamentalists in this group. He describes them as being closed-minded and rigid in their belief system. It's 14%. And what's left, and how much are the atheists, or people who say, I'm not interested in the meaning of life or religion, or, you know, the hardcore scientists who say, consciousness is an illusion. So let's continue with your list, then we'll take some phone calls for you. And Clark, go ahead, please.
Yes. What's left are what I call secularists, and that's a very diverse group, too. Now, there are atheists in America, but not as many as many people think. Americans are not drawn toward atheism particularly, certainly not as much so as people in many other countries. But we do have a lot of agnostics.
Oh, meaning that, what's the difference between an atheist and an agnostic?
An atheist is convinced there's no God.
Okay.
An agnostic is unsure.
Okay.
An agnostic leaves open the possibility, but doesn't affirm belief, whereas an atheist tends to have a pretty firm belief in non-belief, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So there's about 15% or so. I hope all this math adds up to about 100%. If not, somebody out there is going to say I'm not very good with my figures, but they do add up in my book. I've been rounding the figures off here as I've listed them.
Mm-hmm.
But this group called secularists would include some firm atheists, but more agnostics than atheists, and a lot of people who would basically, or sometimes what I call, I happen to be religious. That means I just happen to be Presbyterian. I just happen to be Jewish. I just happen to be whatever.
Oh, I'm not meaning, practicing it, but I just happen to be born into a family.
It means I was born into a family where that's what they said it was, and you know, don't blame me. It just that's the way I was born here. So
I didn't choose it. It chose me.
That's right.
Okay.
And it's a statement of indifference, really. It's a statement of saying I don't really profess any personal faith. But if you force me to have to identify myself, then I happen to be
mm-hmm.
Episcopalian or whatever.
Okay.
So you have some of those folks. And then you've got these true agnostics who say, well, I don't believe in organized religion, but then, I don't know, maybe there's a God, maybe there isn't. And then what do you mean by God? Are you talking about some prime force in the universe? Maybe, maybe not. What do we mean by the word God? There's a lot of uncertainty talk out there today. And these people I'm calling the secularists do a lot of that. But I can tell you there's a lot of uncertainty talk across all these categories.
Right.
I'm not at all saying that there aren't many firm believers. They certainly are. But there are a lot of people open to the possibility that they might actually learn something new. That is, they're open to the idea of exploring. They're open to the idea that they actually might be wisdom from other places.
Oh, you'd have to put me in that one, because I'm not a joiner. I couldn't follow someone else's dictums.
Mm-hmm.
I have to pioneer my own journey, and I feel like I've lived when I'm on my third lifetime within the scope of this one, so I have to be ready to go wherever the next adventure calls me. You know, so I'm not committed. I can't commit. So what is that? Do you find a lot of people like that? I believe there's something there. I just haven't decided what that is yet.
One way of thinking about the change in spirituality, and it's not an idea totally new with me, that another sociologist has said this, but I think it's absolutely correct, that there's been a shift, and perhaps particularly in this generation, from what might be called place-centered or tradition-centered spirituality to process.
Process, that's me, okay.
Now, process spirituality will emphasize journey,
mm-hmm.
growth,
yep.
development, moving into the unknown, whereas tradition or place-centered spirituality has emphasized more a set type of rituals and beliefs and
belonging to a group.
That been inherited from the past and seemingly always true and therefore will always be true. And of course there's still some of that in the United States, but we have a lot of our culture today is focused around process. And in process thinking, one is open to learning new things.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, part of what it seems to me is happening is what I call a reflexive kind of spirituality. That word reflexive simply means self-monitoring. That is, we are in a situation increasingly in the world where we know we must cultivate our own. We must take responsibility for our own spirituality, for our own growth, for our own journey. And that kind of reflexive spirituality, I believe, is on the increase.
What percentage would you give that right now?
Very difficult to put a percentage on that. It's a theme that seems terribly pronounced among people born since World War II. And I'm talking not just about the baby boomers, but also Generation Xers. Those in their 20s and early 30s are even more of this reflexive sort. And, I mean, this younger generation is a generation born on the Internet, with the Internet, information overload, if you will, but exposed to diversity even greater than the baby boomers were exposed at a comparable age. So I think with increased exposure to other traditions and other religions and other cultures, we are forced to become more self-reflexive, to think through what we ourselves believe amidst so much contrary belief.
Life is not a destination, but a journey happens to be one of my favorite sayings. And let's take a break and come right back with Clark Roof and your phone calls. More contemplation on what's the meaning of life and where do you fit in to the picture in the search. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show as we continue the conversation with Clark Roof, sociologist looking at America's religious and spiritual subgroups today. Oh, man, I'm having an epiphany. I do belong somewhere to the process group, and I thought I defied categorization. Oh, this is fun. So as we take your calls, state your subgroup and share your comments. We'll start with John in Seattle, Washington, listening to KVI. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
I sure am.
I guess I would have to be placed in the process group as well, and more like your previous guest, who, you know, I realize in my lifetime I'll never have all the answers, and I'm comfortable with that.
Me too. Make friends with
I'd like to ask a couple questions, if I could, because they're both interrelated.
Go ahead.
Well, it seems to me that most people who claim to be on a spiritual truth, you know, or search for truth, seem to out of hand discount all traditional beliefs, you know, such as Jesus couldn't have been, you know, who he stated to be, or at least as the Bible presents it. And the second question is probably a little more unanswerable, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you think the truth exists? And by that I mean, if there's a point where pure science and pure religion, if you will, can or ever will meet.
An interesting question, Clark.
Those are interesting questions. On the first one about people searching on journeys, do they believe in traditional doctrines?
They seem to just throw out traditional beliefs without any scientific evidence that they don't exist.
Well, actually, I think what happens for a lot of people is that they throw out maybe one way of thinking about, say, Jesus. Maybe the aspects associated with virgin birth or walking on water or miracles of some sort. But at another level, they can find the teachings of Jesus quite important, just as they might find the teachings, Native American teachings, or the teachings of the Buddha important. So I think one can recognize a great prophet. One can even say that this particular teacher is the teacher I want to follow, and at the same time, not necessarily accept all the inherited teachings about that particular teacher.
I've heard a lot of talk about, science continuing to discover, the nature of life or measurable experiences. And, they've said, with all that we know now, and then state their point. And to me, it's with all that we know now proves that in time there will be other things that exist that we don't understand now.
I think that's right.
Jesus could have performed those miracles and those things, and we just don't understand it yet.
That is certainly possible. I think what's fascinating is that that the physicists are among the people most inclined toward being spiritually minded.
Really?
That's true. I mean, there are studies that show among academics that physicists, particularly those who study outer space,
the astrophysicists,
are particularly inclined toward belief in some prime mover, God, force, whatever you want to call it. And what strikes me is that science and religion, while they're often posed as being diametrically opposite, in many ways they come together. It's two different kinds of languages talking about the same thing. But often those languages are not so much at odds with one another. One's a language of how science deals with questions of how things happen.
Well, they have a long...
But religion deals with questions about why, and places that in a much larger framework. It's like comparing a literal account of something with a poem. Both can express truth, but it's truth in different ways.
I've always seen that analogy between physics, high-level theoretical physics, and religion, because it seems that at its most fundamental, it's describing what ancient wisdom used to describe in more poetic terms about the nature of the universe and its structure. And also, Newton was a physicist and a mystic as well, so you have a long tradition of that. He was searching how God created the universe, what are the rules through which it worked to find more, to get closer to God. You also have Einstein talking about God rolling the dice.
Exactly.
You have modern scientist George Smoot talking about finding the fingerprints of God and the background radiation from the first moment after the Big Bang. So, yeah, let me see what you're saying. Anything else that you wanted to pose, John?
No, thank you. That's it's a good start in the discussion.
Thanks. Thanks for telling us. Richard in Pacific Grove, California, state your subgroup, and you're on with Clark Roof.
Laura Lee?
Yes.
This is Richard Andelson, you know, with the John Stein MacArthur and Spiritual Society.
Oh, yes. Hello
again. We talked once before. Isn't Laura Lee a Southern name?
Well, I suppose it could be.
You know, I think a lot of people, I don't know if Clark realizes, a very unusual thing happened in America in the South because we had an aristocracy, and the main product down there was hemp, or what we might call marijuana. And it all through the South, you could have the odoriferous aspect of it, which it was a certain form of enlightenment. Now, the young people there, by the parents, were sent to Europe for their education. It was called Greek Revival. And Thomas Jefferson, I think, is one of the most greatest representations of the Southern aristocracy. And he was over in Europe and researching the life of Jesus Christ. And in a book called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, which was published by the United States Congress, and the first edition is buried in the Jefferson tomb with him, he indicates that Christ was actually the son of a Greek centurion named Pantera, who had sex with Mary. John Adams said, if that man ever gets in the White House, the devil will ruin our country. I think many people have forgotten that about America. And if there is a spiritual purpose, I think our spiritual purpose is to maintain what I call Western civilization. Now, at the time of Heisenberg and Rutherford, and the concept of our science, as we were making breakthroughs in terms of atomic energy, many people have forgotten that in Cleveland, Ohio, Michelson and Morley were given money to find out and decide whether ether existed or it did not exist. Well, as a matter of fact, after a long period of experimentation, a great deal of money...
I have 1 minute left.
They were unable to prove the existence of ether or the non-existence of it. Then Einstein formulated the theory of relativity, in discounting most of the matter in the universe and constituting on a small fraction of it, and therefore constituting what we now have as a mechanistic observation of our universe instead of an etheric observation of our universe. And people will find we have an etheric body and the etheric relationship with the universe, and our true relationship with God must come through the etheric world. And in the present concept of the mechanization of our observation in the digital binary world, we're evading the etheric analogy of the observation of ourselves and our etheric relationship with the universe. That's one of the paradoxes of our time. And I don't know if Clark understands exactly what I'm saying, but I'm referencing that to the form of our search for our spiritual being.
See? The pondering is endless. That's what makes this discussion so rich and varied. Every time you talk about the meaning of life and your relationship to it. We continue with our guest, Clark Roof. He's the author of A Generation of Seekers and This Spiritual Marketplace. He's described the subgroups of America today. What subgroup are you a member of, and what comments do you have? I'm Laura Lee. This is The Laura Lee Show, and our guest is Clark Roof, author of A Generation of Seekers and The Spiritual Marketplace. Fascinating reads if you're on a quest today for the meaning of life. Find out what your fellow Americans are doing. You can call 800-243-1438 for copies of those books and a tape of this interview. And visit our website at lauralee.com. And, you know, it's interesting, Clark, our last caller was pointing out that America was founded on religious freedom. That's what many of the first settlers were seeking to establish when they came to this through an arduous journey, left their homeland to come here. And B, our founding fathers, many of them were Freemasons who practice an open spirituality. All that you had to have in common was a belief in God. And interesting points. Next caller is Carrie in Colorado. Hello, Carrie. Hi, Carrie.
Favorite subject, what you're talking about. And what I'd like to say is, you know, the Creator, when He created everything, He never went anywhere. And everybody says God's somewhere else. He's all around everywhere you see. Even Paul in the Bible spoke to the Greeks. and said, I see you worship the unknown God, you know. And he said that to reach out and feel around happily, you know, that you dwell on him. He lives in us, and he's all around about you, you know. That's why he said reach out and feel around happily, because that's the creator, you know. He's everywhere present. And
that's a good point. Clark, your comments?
Well, I would say that many Americans today are reaffirming a belief that God is, whatever God is a presence in this life, and not just some otherworldly force or presence. People are exploring and I think finding the sacred in the midst of everyday life. And I think if that's what the caller means by the presence of God, then I would say that's something that many people today are indeed discovering and practicing.
What if you have a universal concept of God? There's an innate divine intelligence out there. There's a grand plan to all this. And you have had experiences with angels, say, you know, God's direct emissaries. Hey, he's kind of a busy guy. He's got a whole universe to take care of, so he sent an angel. That's common. People are having experiences, direct experiences of mystical moments of encountering angels, near-death experiences. So much of this, we believe in it, I believe, because it happens to us.
It's
not a belief, it's an experience as opposed to a belief.
It's the case that many Americans claim to have these kinds of experiences. People are looking for experiential religion today. So they're not looking for some cold, dry set of doctrines. They're looking for something that's lively, experiential. And I think the belief in angels is a reflection of this search for something deeply personal, touching, directly related to them. An aspect of religion that touches your life very, very closely and often very intimately.
Or these things happen to you and then you have to go search for a context in which to put them, to make sense out of them.
Well, certainly that's the case too. Things happen and then people look for explanations, and this is what the great German sociologist almost a century ago, Max Weber, called a theodicy. We look for an explanation, and we often assign a divine explanation to it or a sacred explanation, so it becomes a theodicy.
Oh, I like that.
That is, it's an interpretation of an event.
Uh-huh.
It can be an interpretation of a terrible thing as well. I mean, why suffering occurs, or why something awful happens. It can also be an explanation of something that's very good. And you know, the spiritual is and religion generally is often that which we have a hard time putting a name to.
Yeah.
That is, you can't. In fact, one of the great Chinese spiritual teachers of a couple of centuries ago once said that the best, you know, the most meaningful things in life you cannot describe in words.
They're ineffable. They're beyond.
That's right.
Description. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So. What's fascinating to think about is, as one of the first callers on tonight's show said about wars over religion all over the globe, which is absolutely true, but what people fight about in the name of religion are often things that they can talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But the deeper things of religion, the deeper mm-hmm. things that are spiritual, people don't fight over that because those are things they really can't put names on.
And I don't think, I agree with you, we can't afford to fight any longer over this. We have to allow everyone to make sense of it as long as they're not harming others. We can't hit someone over the head and say, you have to believe the way I believe.
Not in a world where we have nuclear energy can we afford to go to battle over our belief. I mean, I think one of the things that's drawing the world together globally is a concern about peace. And secondly, a concern about the environment. People I talk to are very deeply concerned about both of those. And those are strong unifying forces. And I think when we look closely at the religions of the world and the spiritual teachings of the world, despite what on the surface might appear to be differences among them, when you get right down to it, they all have something to say about peace. They all have something to say about love. They all have something to say about creation or environment. So there are many unifying features. If we can only get beyond our doctrinal interpretations of what those things are about, and we can get beyond that to the real meaning that lies behind it, then I think human beings will discover the unity that exists.
Maybe it's the Gemini in me, but I see that this group has a point. This group has some wisdom here. This group has a key insight. I don't think you're going to find the whole truth wrapped up in any one group. I think it's spread out among all of the various threads that make up the human tapestry.
Mm-hmm.
Call me a pluralist. We go next to Jay in Boise, Idaho on KIDO. Hi, Jay. You're on with Clark Roof.
Hi. Hello.
You're on the air.
Hi. I want to say that the power of the spirit is with all of us, and I don't think that anything is going to destroy this planet unless we decide to destroy it ourselves.
That's a good point. Thank you for that. Larry in San Francisco, you're next. Hello. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I haven't heard very much of the show, so I hope this is on point. But I think when you're talking about being a spiritual seeker in our consumerist society, you know, so many people, when they're and you see this, of course, a lot in the New Age and other, you know, aspects of mass media, religion, like, you know, the televangelists and so on. People go shopping for a religion like they go shopping for a toothpaste. And it becomes not about truth, but about what my preferences are.
But I see your point, and this is a question you do ask in your book, Clark, which is, are we using religion as a series of trends? Are we hopping from one to another? Your input for Larry?
Oh, sure. There's a fair amount of that in the United States today of people. It's sometimes called church hopping within the religious sector, but in a broader sense, I guess you might say there's a lot of spiritual hopping from one teacher, one set of principles to another. And to me, that's an indicator of just how thirsty or hungry, depending on what metaphor you want to use, people are for finding some deeper spiritual meaning. I think if I can respond to the previous speaker, I think it's fair to say that there are two sides to this spiritual searching. There's definitely a shallow, flaky side, if you will, and we see certainly some of that. But there's also a very serious side to much of it. And each instance has to be analyzed carefully. I think you can see the trivial, sometimes flaky aspect of much of this, but you know you can see it in any religion. It's not just in New Age. There's a lot within all the religions that's very commercial, very much focused around consumption, taste, preferences. Even dogmatists have their own preferences. So every religion has that side to it. But then I think there's also this serious side, and it's a little unfair to characterize a movement or a religious group as either one or the other. You've got both wrapped up in it.
Larry, what subgroup would you identify with that Clark has described tonight?
Well, I like I said, I just tuned in, so I didn't hear what the subgroups.
That's right.
What the subgroups are, but you know what I'm seeing. I see a lot of spiritually hungry people, people that are starving, and starving people will eat dirt, will eat garbage, will eat poison. You know, they'll eat things that are bad for them.
That's
and
your point.
I see the same thing. I see the same thing spiritually.
What
the
is your spiritual?
So desperate.
What is your spiritual path? Have you found one that?
Yeah, I'm a Christian.
Which kind? There's so many
well,
kinds.
Laura, basically, there's really only one kind. The ones that follow Jesus. Unfortunately,
I just wanted to know where you were coming from.
The Christians, don't be mistaken. I'm you know the Christians that get the media, like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. I mean, I don't know who they're following, but they're not following the Lord because of what the Christian path is about love. It's not about putting anyone down. It's not about division. It's about bringing people together.
Thank
you
for that.
That's the path I follow, the path of love.
Thank you.
Can I say one more thing? That
go ahead.
Your
just don't
speaker
repeat yourself.
Said one thing that really sent chills up my spine. It's one of these cliches that people throw out, and I guess they don't realize what they're saying. He said, "What's important is experience and not dry doctrine." Well, you know. Doctrines are very important to me, and for instance, I believe in the doctrine of the Trinity, and there's nothing dry about it at all. It's sustaining to me. When I think of God, I think of a God that is relational, that because God is not one thing but three persons, God is in himself a relationship. And that gives me a clue about how I live my life.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you.
The meaning of my life is also relational, how I relate to God and how I relate to other people. So that's a doctrine, but it's not a dry, dusty, boring doctrine.
That wouldn't fit into that category. But there are plenty of dry, dusty doctrines out there.
But I think your speaker was indicating that doctrines are these dry, dusty, boring
Let's
things.
Ask him to speak for himself, and thank you for your input, Larry. And when we come back, let's ask our guest, Wade Clark Roof, have you looked into one's psychological makeup, maybe the family upbringing, maybe, you know, is there a relationship to the subcultures one eventually finds oneself in and the kind of therapy one needs, what one's using to put their life together? You know, you tend to go for what you need in life. Do different subgroups provide different comfort in people's psychology? That would be an interesting question. Let's tackle that next right here on The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee. I'm Laura Lee. This is The Laura Lee Show. We have 10 minutes left to spend with Clark Roof tonight. To which subgroup do you belong and why? I'd like to hear your answers. And in the meantime, Clark, I love it when a caller calls in and adds a bit of sizzle there. I wanted you to describe what you meant by, quote, dry doctrine, and then do you find any correlation, any insights into the subgroups that people eventually find themselves identifying with and some psychological need?
Well, it's a fascinating question. Certainly our surveys suggest that many people today are turned off with many of the traditional doctrines, and they're looking for expressions of God in their life that's new and creative. Now, there's nothing wrong with doctrine, and let me just say in defense of the man who called in about doctrine, doctrine is a formulation of affirmation in God. It's one formulation among many. And various people will hold to various formulations. For many Christians, the notion of the Trinity is very, very important. For many other Christians, it's less important. Mystics, for example, in the Christian tradition, often reject the notion of the Trinity and think more about the presence of God within, within one's own self. And mysticism today is a very important kind of religious orientation. So, you know, this whole thing about religion is like signposts to a larger reality. And sometimes the doctrines are just a signpost, and we don't, we shouldn't turn the doctrines into gods. The signposts only point toward the larger reality. And I would say that's true even for a notion like the Trinity. Now, with respect to psychological needs, we all have needs for security and acceptance and love and so forth, basic human needs. With respect to variations in religious belief, I think much of how we talk about God, much of how we think about the sacred is related to our backgrounds, of course, the way we were brought up, the kinds of language that we use, the cultures in which we grew up have shaped our thinking. And then I think in our everyday life experiences, people who have happy lives, and I don't mean happy in some superficial sense, but basically are satisfied with their lives, their love relationships, their intimate relationships, their work relationships. The people who are basically happy and satisfied with life are people who can affirm faith in God or some higher power or spirit in a very open and creative and loving manner. People who are not so happy in all of those earthly kinds of relationships and situations often cling to a notion of a deity that's much more rigid and narrow. So the psychological profiling of Americans today is a fascinating way of trying to get at how they think about the sacred. It's very clear that that people who experience love often have an open view about God as love. People who don't experience as much love, genuine love in their own ordinary everyday lives, are much more inclined to have a more rigid, dogmatic view of God.
I have 2 minutes left to spend with you tonight, and I just want to say thank you. This has been most enjoyable, insightful. It's just a real treat to talk about this with someone who's studied it in the way that you have and in depth that you've had, and that whose opinions I agree so much with.
So. Well, thank you. It's been a joy to have this conversation. And note, and please, all you people in the radio audience, note that I'm not a theologian. I'm a sociologist. I'm interested in how people think. I'm not interested in making my own normative judgments about whether they're right or wrong, or is there a God or isn't there. That's not really with what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to understand what Americans in 1999 are saying about what they believe and about the purpose of life. And what's fascinating is the diversity that we find out there today, but also the fact that there is this hunger to find something more. And it's the search for the something more which suggests to me that we're in a time of, I think we could call it a spiritual awakening, but that doesn't mean that it's a turning back to a particular type of Christianity or to any particular type of religion. There is a hunger for spiritual truth that cuts across all traditions now. And I think that's what we're into today, a kind of spiritual quest for meaning and purpose in life wherever people find it.
And you're just reporting.
And I'm just reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I may fumble in my ways of describing what's out there.
I didn't hear a fumble.
But if you don't like what I describe, the fact of the matter is... That's what's out there.
So.
It's a pretty diverse world out there.
Thanks so much. Read A Generation of Seekers and Spiritual Marketplace, full of insights. You may find yourself among those groups. Thanks so much, Clark Roof. I'm Laura Lee. This has been Conversation for Exploration, and I want to thank you for joining us on our tour around the universe at large here tonight. And join us next time. I'm Laura Lee.